This week's After Dinner speaker in the studio for the first time in a long time is a largely libertarian thinker, chief economist with the New Zealand Initiative, Eric Crampton. Eric, lovely to see you.
Great to be back.
Now, we were just talking before we went on air on someone. I don't want to go into this too much, but you've just obviously, you've seen a lot of bad legislation or bad reform going across, in your opinion, going across your desk in the past few weeks, right?
Oh, yeah. There's a lot of targets out there, a lot of pretty wrong-headed policies. I didn't want to come in and complain about all those tonight. I wanted to talk about something happier,
yes,
like my favorite economist.
Yeah, but before we do, just the supermarkets, just for example there. Now, the government is trying to loosen the power of the duopoly, which at the moment it argues is extracting more than its fair share of profit from us ordinary battler Kiwis.
So, have we talked supermarkets before?
No, we haven't.
Are you sure?
Yeah, we might have. I can't
remember. If we haven't, I can give you... Okay, here's what's going on, all right? Since I've gotten here, it's been basically impossible to open up a new supermarket chain.
In the early... Yes, we have.
Yeah. So land use regulation zoning makes it just impossible for a new entrant to get in. There are very few sites that cities zone for new supermarkets, and the ones that have been zoned during the 2000s and earlier, the existing supermarkets had locked those up in covenants. So it is impossible for Aldi or anybody else to come in and compete, so you get a restricted market and some of the problems that flow with that. Now, the Commerce Commission very rightly said, okay, their initial study didn't make a lot of sense. They took submissions. They thought about it again. We'd been making the case pretty heavily about these barriers to entry and the importance of those. They reconsidered. They put out a report saying, we need to address these regulatory barriers to entry. We need to make it easy for new supermarkets to come in. Now you've got Minister Clark coming in and saying that, well, we need to mandate access into the warehouses for competitors to the existing vertically integrated supermarket chains. Well, that's just going to be impossible to police, right? These aren't bits in a telecom cabinet. These are bits of dry goods and produce that are sometimes going to be expiring or of varying quality that you can only assess when you look at it. My parents had a market garden for a little bit when I was a kid. I know about going into these warehouses and picking produce and trying to find the stuff that's still good. If you're mandating access in this way, you're going to be having to make sure that the wholesaler isn't sending the seconds out to their competitors, right? It's going to need an army of bureaucrats running this whole thing when all you really need to have is open up the zoning and the Overseas Investment Act so Aldi and Lidl and a bunch of others can come in and start up. It's just
right.
All nuts.
Which is what we talked about, that access in terms of access to entry and land zoning and all that last time.
But all that
time
makes me angry.
Yes,
and
yeah.
Tulloch makes me happy.
Yeah. Right, let's go to the positive now. Gordon Tulloch. Until you sent your notes through, I had not heard of Gordon Tulloch.
You don't,
but I probably have heard of his ideas in various guises from various people over the years. Who was he?
Gordon Tulloch is probably the world's best economist. The one who... Well, he died a few years ago, 2014, born in 1922. He's one of my profs when I went to grad school at George Mason University. He founded the field of public choice, which applies economic intuitions and logic and analysis to political decision making. He basically invented that field, as well as sparking a lot of others. He was very important in the founding of the law and economics movement. He even applied economic intuition into choices of non-human species. So looking at behavior of birds, for example, and selecting places to go, and it was a coal tit. It's a bird that would peck on trees to try and get bugs out of them, and just modeled their decision functions and what you'd expect if they were following an economically rational pattern and seeing whether that matches up. Brilliant guy. So when I used to teach at Canterbury, I would tell my students of the pantheon of the econ gods. So you'd have the elder gods, the Milton Friedmans, the George Stigler.
The Adam Smith? Surely he gets in there somewhere.
Absolutely, but I was looking more at the modern era.
Right, okay.
And but above all of them, hurling thunderbolts of fury at all those who displeased him, was Gordon Tulloch. So Gordon was what you call a natural economist. He'd only taken one course in economics really early on. He studied at the University of Chicago, but for a law degree, not for an economics degree. He took one course in economics from Henry Simons, himself a really good and important founder of the Chicago School. But Tulloch went on from there into legal practice, and as he explained it, he won a case that he should have lost, and he lost a case that he should have won, and he was encouraged by the firm to think about something else as a career. So he went over to the State Department and the Foreign Service. So he tested for that, and he served from 47 to 56. He was in Tientsin when the Chinese communists overran it. But he picked up a lot of insights about bureaucracy from his time working in the Foreign Service, which led him to, because he was sort of a natural economics thinker, that he's always putting things into that kind of a framework. He was applying that, thinking about how the public service was running, but also seeing it in other aspects of what he was seeing, for example, in China. So he would tell the story in class about how he observed barges being pulled up canals. So they'd have people who were pulling on ropes, the ropes attached to the barge pulling, barge being pulled up through the canal by manpower. But there was a guy holding the whip to make sure that everybody was working hard. So Tulloch was curious what was going on. Was this some form of slavery? Was it just really inadequate labor rights? Something really weird going on? And found out, well, actually, no. The workers were crews who were self-managing, and they all knew that any one of them would slack off if they were not monitored, because none of them could watch the others while they were all pulling really hard. Like, if you're pulling really hard on that rope, you're not watching the guy behind you, and you might have half a view of the guy ahead of you, but not reliably. So they all agreed that one of their own members would be the guy holding the whip, who would watch all of them and make sure that they would all be able to get paid at the end of it, because you didn't get paid if you didn't get your cargo there on time or you had a penalty. So it's a beautiful little insight about self-organization, the utility-enhancing constraints, that sometimes you might want to pay the guy with the whip to make sure that you're all working really hard, and it's totally done voluntarily. It's just a neat little insight, applying that intuition afterwards. He started writing on bureaucracy then, once he got back after his time in the Foreign Service. That attracted the attention of James Buchanan, who was the other founder of the field of public choice. He was at the University of Virginia at the time, invited Gordon Tulloch out to start giving a few guest lectures, hang out for a bit, start working together, and that's what founded the field. So Tulloch had his book on bureaucracy that came out. He started writing on sort of proto-public choice insights around log rolling in 1959.
What was his basic view of bureaucracy, if it's possible to have a basic one? Was it that bureaucracy is generally bad?
That bureaus are, everyone working in a bureau is as self-interested as everyone else outside of a bureau, and they're all maximizing their own utility as they see it, and there's a logic that extends from there. So in later work, he'd argue that, well, there can be problems if government starts getting to be too large relative to the overall economy if civil servants are voting, because they will all vote to further expand the size and pay of the public sector. So he suggested that civil servants should not be voting.
Right.
Yeah. It'd be a wonderful thing to have change in Wellington, eh? It'd be a little different.
Do you think that's practical, Eric? Was that a thought experiment?
I think it was a fun insight. I don't think that he expected anybody to pick up on it or to run with it, but there is an inexorable logic there, right? Normally, you don't have people voting on their own pay packets. Effectively, public servants kind of do through who they might vote for in national elections.
Could you throw that logic in another direction and say, well, no taxpayer should vote because we'll always vote for lower taxes, even if we need higher taxes?
Well, normally you'd want the people who are funding something to have some say over it.
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
But those weren't the main Tulloch insights. The really big ones came in his work that came... Well, there are lots of reasons that Gordon Tulloch should have gotten the Nobel Prize, and lots of reasons that he didn't. We can get into that a little bit later. But the key insights really were his work on rent-seeking and his work on constitutional political economy and the calculus of consent.
What's rent-seeking?
So traditionally in economics, we were talking about monopoly and duopoly earlier, right? So the traditional problem that you have with monopoly in a very classical economic sense is that the monopolist charges a little bit too much. They restrict output. They charge more than a competitive market would, because if they increased their output by a little bit, they would reduce the price that they get on all the prior units of the goods sold. So you get this deadweight loss, this cost that's borne by society as a whole that's in excess of any benefit that's received by the monopolist. Society as a whole would be better off if we could get to the competitive solution. We don't We aren't able to get there. But all of the amount that the monopolist is able to extract in excess profit because they have a monopoly, that's really just a transfer, right? Consumers had that benefit before. Now producers have it. But it's still there. It still continues to exist. Tulloch says, well, just wait a minute. Does that necessarily hold? Like, what happens if the monopoly is actually something that's contestable rather than something that's just decreed by God, right? So there are natural monopolies out there where you have natural monopoly regulation over it. So you'll often think about telecom in that kind of a sense. If in the era when it was a single copper cable going into each house, that it's under sort of natural monopoly regulation. In other areas, though, it's entirely artificial. So in Canada, for example, you have to join the dairy cartel if you want the right to sell milk into the supply-managed system. In other areas, it'll be government-created privileges that create monopoly privileges or other barriers to entry. And those are really valuable, right? And if it's kind of up for grabs who might get them, well, companies are going to compete to be the one that gets the valuable concession from the government. And that process of competition will itself be inherently wasteful. They'll expend real resources hiring people to lobby for them, to make their case, to put up kind of BS economic impact studies claiming how great they are compared to their competitor. All of that destroys real resources to try to attract the transfer. So instead of it just being a transfer for consumers to producers when you have a monopoly case, it is also a real destruction of real value because of the process of trying to compete to get the monopoly in the first place. So I used to illustrate this to my students. I had a lot of fun. And I'd have the lecture on rent seeking. I'd open with an auction. I'd say, I am the local MP. I have managed to negotiate that some company in my constituency is going to be getting this $5 bill that I'd pull out of my wallet, or maybe a $10 bill, depend what I had on the day. But I need to be convinced that each of you, or who's going to be the right person to get this monopoly, right? I don't know who should be getting this grant. You're going to have to convince me. Maybe you can spend a little bit to hire a consultancy to convince me. Now, if you put up your bids. This is the amount that you're spending to get to hire a consultant to put up a report. And whether you win or lose, that money's spent. You have already paid Burl or somebody else to produce the report for you. That money's gone. And if you produce the most convincing report, you'll get the money. So students will start opening the bid because nobody wants to see the $5 just go stay in my pocket, right? So somebody will put up 10 cents. Then somebody else put up 20 cents. Then somebody puts up a dollar. And then somebody else will think through it a little bit more carefully and say $4.90 because they want to deter anybody else from bidding. And then you remind the guy who bid a dollar that, well, right now he's lost a dollar. But if he bids $5.05, well, that's going to be a really good consultancy report. And he's only going to be losing 5 cents then because he's going to be getting my $5. And I'd always make money on these deals. It was right. Great.
So in a real, but also irrational people observing this and thinking, okay, I could get the $5 slush fund from the government, but I might have to spend more than $5 to get it. I won't bother with the slush fund. I'll just make money some other way.
Sure. And that gets into some of the Tulloch puzzle. So Tulloch identified the problem of rent seeking, and theoretically it's undetermined whether you get a perfect rent-seeking result where all of the rents are dissipated in the competition for them, or under-dissipation of the rents, or over-dissipation of the rents. It depends on returns to scale, risk aversion, some other parameters that you can throw in the more complicated models that followed in the literature after Tulloch founded it. But it's not determined ex ante.
So I'm assuming Tulloch saw rent seeking as a problem?
Absolutely.
Okay, and his solution?
There's no good one. And in fact, it gets even worse. So after the 67 piece where Tulloch explains the problem of rent seeking and that, well, really, if we can avoid it, we shouldn't be giving out these kinds of favors in the first place. Tulloch explains why they perpetuate over time. And that was his piece, The Transitional Gains Trap. A beautiful one came out, I think it was 76, where he explains, okay, say that we've now awarded this monopoly privilege. And
the New Zealand Dairy Board for many years.
Let's go back to the Canadian farmers, right? Mm-hmm. So the right to milk, when they set this thing up, well, actually the classic example is New York taxicab medallions. So New York taxicab medallions were set up really when taxis were first starting out.
A medallion?
Yeah.
Did they get a medallion?
You needed a permit to run a taxi cab in New York.
And they called that a medallion.
They did, because it's a gold shield that would stick on the visor, right?
Ah, I see.
Of the car. So does the medallion. It looks like a little shield. It
wasn't like something from the Bee Gees.
No. It would have the cab number giving the authorization to be running a cab. And I'm going from memory now, but it was something like 11,000 of these licenses were issued in the 1920s when this thing first started. The number was never increased until something like the 1990s. So they went from having no economic value to being worth over $1 million because the right to run a cab became very scarce. Population increased. The number of licenses didn't, right? Now, the people who were first granted these licenses, well, they weren't worth anything. It didn't do them much good. Some others bought in, and they've proved to be decent investments. But once you've bought one of these, you are paying for the expected future amounts of extra money that you're going to get because there's a sharp restriction on the number of taxi cabs, and that became more and more valuable as population increased and mobility demands increased. But you've paid for that. And that medallion is almost your retirement fund for a lot of these guys. The auction mechanism for them was pretty efficient. People spent a lot of money on them. Once you had spent that money, everything that you earn running the cab, it isn't making you any better off. You're only earning a normal return on your investment in this monopoly privilege, right? Because if you weren't, people would spend more investing in the medallions up to the point where you're earning no more than a normal rate of return.
So the Gordon Tullock solution would be not to have a licensing system in the first place?
Not to have one in the first place, but you're stuck once this happens. He calls it the trap. So the transitional gain accrues to the people who got in early. Then they end up selling off to others. These others only earn a normal rate of return. If you try and get rid of the medallion system, every one of them will scream bloody murder, and they'll be willing to invest up to the full value of the asset that they would have taken away from them if you got rid of the medallion system to try and keep it in place. And that's why they lobbied so hard to keep Uber from ever getting started, right? Because that erodes the value of the monopoly. Uber didn't really count as a taxi cab because it didn't do the for hailing, right? So you can't, New York, the yellow cabs, put your arm up, the cab shows up, you get in the door. Ubers is point-to-point, you do it on your phone. It didn't come under the same kind of regulation, and they tried hard to keep it out because it was the threat to the value of their taxi medallions. And the value of these just plummeted after we actually liberalized the market through tech.
What would Gordon Tullock say about our supermarket duopoly, do you think, Eric?
He would say that we've got terrible barriers to entry, that if there are real excess profits that are sitting there, like there are some incoherent stories around. Tullock was the ultimate economic rationalist. If your story is implying that there is money sitting on the table for somebody to grab, and you look around and nobody is grabbing it, either you are completely wrong that there's money up for grabs, or there is some substantial regulatory barrier to entry that is preventing people from grabbing it. In the latter case, you should be doing whatever you can to get rid of those regulatory barriers to entry so that competition can happen.
Eric, it's been fascinating. One last thing. I've got about a minute, but I want to ask you about the spike, the thought experiment.
Oh, sure.
And the spike. Did he actually have that thought experiment that maybe if we had a spike in the steering wheel of a driver on the driver's seat, the driver would drive more carefully?
I love that one. It's called the Tullock spike, but I think that it was Alshian that had first come up with the
idea. Sorry, who?
Armin Alshian. He was a UCLA economist. But there's some controversy about who was the first one to come up with the idea of the spike, but it's commonly called the Tullock spike. So he was more illustrating that people respond to incentives and that safety apparatus in cars can make you take a lot more risks. And he would illustrate this by saying, well, by counterexample, imagine if we really cared about the lives of pedestrians, we wouldn't be mandating all these safety features in cars that protect drivers. We would be putting a sharp spike on the steering wheel pointed at the heart of the driver so that the driver is guaranteed to die in an accident. People would drive a lot more carefully in that case, and you'd have a lot fewer pedestrian fatalities.
No one's put that into practice yet, Eric?
No, but I put it on the masthead on my blog. I like that idea. I wouldn't want to put it into practice either. There are much better ways of doing it, but it illustrates the point.
Eric, it's been lovely having you in the studio. Thanks for joining us.
And thanks for getting to have a chance to chat about Tulloch. There's so much more we could have covered. We wasted time on supermarkets.
Oh, we can do a part two, Eric. We can do a part two.
We can hit more of it another time, sure.
Eric Crampton from the New Zealand Initiative, talking about Gordon Tulloch, his favourite economist.